Hello, everyone, and welcome to the teleclass Meet the Press, Tips and Techniques for Dealing with the Media. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of Professor Syed Tatar, the co-founder of the Teleclass Education Initiative, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. Now, today is a bit of a departure from our norm. It is rare for us to invite a speaker from a private company to give a lecture in our series. Usually they're from a university or a hospital or a government, but Jim Armour is a worthy exception. He is Vice President of Public Affairs at Summa Strategies Canada, Inc., and has extensive knowledge of media relations, communications, advocacy, and advertising. In the past, Mr. Armour has served as Director of Communications and Marketing at the Canadian Medical Association. He sits on the editorial board of the International Journal of Communication in Healthcare, and he was communications director for two leaders of the official opposition in Canada's Parliament. He is, I believe, the very best person to give this lecture, and his slides look really fascinating, so I will let him get to it. From beautiful Ottawa, Canada, I am pleased to present Mr. Jim Armour. Jim.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Paul, for that introduction. Just for those following along, I'll move on to slide number two. Now, if you ask anybody what some of their greatest fears are, most would say that public speaking would rank right up there. But if you press them a little bit more, you would probably get an answer that a media interview appearing on camera would probably be rank even higher than public speaking. And I found this picture of even President Ahmadinejad of Iran, who really has very little to fear from the press. You can see him in the background there. Obviously, there's some occasion when he thinks twice about appearing before a bank of press microphones. So in slide number three, just to go over briefly what the goals of this session are. In terms of very general goals, I would like you to feel at the end of this session a little bit more comfortable about the idea of doing a media interview, being asked questions either on the telephone or in a radio studio or in front of a TV camera. I'd also like to instill a little bit of confidence going over some of the tips and techniques and the rules so that you're going to feel confident when that call comes instead of fearful. And the last thing very generally that I'd like to impart hopefully is a sense that you actually have a little bit more control than you think starting out. Just because you're the person answering the questions doesn't mean that you don't have any of the power, that you actually have a fair amount of control over the interview and over the situation that you find yourself in. So on to slide four. Now, more practically, what I'd also like to do, hopefully at the end of the session and throughout, is give you a series of practical tips. What you should be doing when reporters call looking for a media interview. Also, I'll go over ways that you can craft a fairly memorable message, memorable in a good way, not necessarily in a bad way, and also to take a look at some of the pitfalls that you could encounter, how to maximize, again, the impact, the positive impact that you're going to be having in avoiding some of the pitfalls. And then finally, just getting the best from every single interview, whether it's an on-camera interview, a print interview, or on radio. Next slide. So I thought where I would start is to give you a little bit of an idea of the people on the other side of the microphone or the camera. Because it's good to get a little bit of understanding into journalists and reporters, just so you know where they're coming from when they're asking questions of you. For the most part, journalists, if you ask them why they're in journalism in the first place, it's you'll hear things like informing the public, that it's a public duty, that there's an old line, I think, that they're there to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. So that's generally the motivation, the professional motivation behind a lot of journalists. They view it as a public service, they are there to inform the public and tell them things that they may not necessarily know. The second thing is to have an idea about what makes news. You just need to look at any newspaper or turn on any TV and realize that it's not that usually it's not positive, happy stories that that make the news, unless there's some entertainment value and, you know, a puppy dog is not only found but has walked miles for days and days and days to find its owner. That might make news. But what generally makes news is conflict, having two sides of a story, that more than anything is what makes news. In terms of the objectives of a good story, well, first of all, the objective is to tell a good story and to impart knowledge and understanding that the reader or the viewer wouldn't necessarily have. Another objective is to be balanced. Journalists always want to be fair and balanced. And now, what that means is that they simply need to have two sides to every story. I know a lot of people, especially in the scientific community, are often frustrated at who journalists go to for that opposite side of the story. A lot of people would view the opposite side as being junk science, and how could anybody with any sort of knowledge go to so-and-so for a comment? But to a reporter, as long as you have two people saying opposite things, that's a balanced story. Another thing to remember about journalism is just simply the environment that they work in. Journalists are always on deadline. They're always under extreme pressure. They generally work for people who yell a lot and who yell at them a lot, and they never like to get beaten on a story. So it's not always the happiest of environments. So a little bit of if you keep that in mind when you're either answering their questions or dealing with them, that's not a bad thing. That'll put you in good stead. Another thing to keep in mind about journalism and about reporters is there are some general rules of the game to keep in mind. Probably two of the most important ones is that you're always on the record. So anything that you say to a journalist, unless you've made some sort of prior arrangement and you know he or she very well and you have a good established working relationship and you can lay some groundwork before the interview, you know, you might be able to put things on background, but that's fairly rare and it takes a while. But it's good just to keep in the back of your mind that anything that you do say to a journalist can and possibly will be used against you, not necessarily in a court of law, but something worse in the newspapers. So on top of that, again, and this goes to the working environment, that there's always a deadline and always that pressure. So, you know, your word is your bond when dealing with journalists. You need to be able to tell them when you're going to be able to do an interview, when you're going to be able to get back to them, and never, ever lie to a journalist. That's the game over right there before you start. Now, on the next slide, I've just got a quick overview of what I hope to cover over the next little while. And it's really broken down into three major sections. The first being what to say, and that's largely you know, how to determine what your message is in any interview, the proper use of facts, and most importantly, just who your audience is and how to tailor your message to address and to attract that audience. The second section is how to say it. So being memorable, again, in a good way. How to avoid pitfalls, and also how to bridge away from trouble. And bridging is a specific technique, and I'll get into that later in the seminar. And then finally, running through where to say it. So going through some of the things to keep in mind when you're doing a print interview or a radio or television interview, also news conferences, and then the dreaded scrum if you ever find yourself in that position. So on slide 7, just to give you an idea of what I'm going to be saying about what to say, there's three things to keep in mind, and I seem to keep coming back to three things all the time. I'm the son of a Presbyterian minister, and we were always taught that every good sermon should have at least three points. So there's a lot of threes in some of my slides. But in terms of what to say, what I'm going to be covering is the need to state it, the need to support it, and then possibly, most importantly, the need to simplify things. So let's start with state it. So on the next slide, I've got what I consider to be the golden rule, and that's never try and wing it. When you're about to do an interview or you've got an interview scheduled, it always pays to take the time to draw up a quick plan. It doesn't have to be much, but you should never go into an interview cold without giving some thought about what it is you hope to accomplish, what it is you want to say, and possibly the best way to say it, and also give some thought about the potential questions that you're going to be asked. So if you have time to set aside 5-10 minutes, the longer the better if you can, just to run through things in your head, jot a few notes maybe on, the back of a napkin or on a notepad, that will come in very, very handy as you go forward. Now, another thing to help you on the next slide, when you're going through jotting down a few notes, there's variations on this, but what I like to use is something that's called a message box. And it's got four sections to it, and it just helps you to organize your thinking a little bit. So the first box is, what are we saying about ourselves or about our issue? It could be emergency room crowding. It could be the need to wash hands in a hospital setting. It could be H1N1. Whatever the issue, it's good to spend a couple of minutes jotting down what are we saying about the organization or the issue that you're being interviewed about. Then with that idea that reporters are going to go to someone else for their comments, it's good to jot down what are they being the opponents, the opposing view, what are they saying about themselves or about their issue? And then further down, what are they saying, what are we saying about them? And then what are they saying about us? And that's quite useful. You can use it a number of ways, and for a number of issues, it's pretty flexible. But it's a good way of organizing your thinking before an interview, because a reporter is likely going to be touching on those boxes at some point in the interview. So on the next slide, I have start with a positioning statement. So that's the one thing that you want them, the audience, to remember about your issue or your topic or about the organization. So you know, most interviews start off fairly generally. If you're working on some sort of project that's doing some cancer research, the question could be, well, Dr. So-and-so, what has your research found, or we hear it has found this. So you usually get a chance to start off with that one thing that you want them to remember, because it's a fairly general beginning to most interviews. But it's good to spend some time and to jot down that one thing that you want people to take away. And on the next slide, Another important thing about your planning process is to give some thought about your audience. So who is it that's going to be on the receiving end of your pearls of wisdom or the answers to the questions? And I've got a couple of examples up on my slide there. But the first is, you know, sometimes you're dealing with morning television. So, you know, morning television tends to be fairly light. Their goal is to inform people. You know, what is that useful bit of information that they may need around the water cooler to sound informed and intelligent? So it's people rushing around, you know, making kids' lunches, trying to figure out breakfast, get dressed for work. So most of those interviews don't last very long. The reporters and anchors are usually worried about the time clock. They haven't had much time to either figure out who you are or what issue that you're talking about. So, you know, your answers would have to attract and to reach that audience. Another, you know, you'd take a different approach if it was a more in-depth radio interview, or perhaps CBC Television is the public broadcaster here in Canada. Usually they have an awful lot more time than private radio or private TV, so you can get into a little bit more detail, with them. You may be on a rock station who have even less time than breakfast television and less interest probably in what you have to say. So you'd obviously answer them a little bit differently. And then there's the you know, the peer-reviewed journals like the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Obviously, you'd take a little bit different approach to them than you would with KROQ 89.3. At least I hope you would. But it's always a good idea to keep your audience in mind and do that in the planning process. So that gives you an idea of what sort of detail you're going to go into in your answers. Now on to the next slide and the next area, and that's the second S, is supporting things. So you need to support it. You need to support your statement. So all those messages that you've worked on in your message box and in drafting up your plan, it's important that that you support it in some way. And a good rule of thumb to keep in mind is, why should people care? So why should people care about your topic or your issue or the organization that you're speaking on behalf of? And that's a good way of just thinking right off the bat, you know, what is the most important thing that I can impart, and why, you know, why should people care about my research you know, the infectious disease and the public safety issue that I'm perhaps discussing. The second thing is to keep in mind that facts are really good, figures are very bad. So just let me explain that. The more zeros you have, the more percentages, the more numbers, the sooner people are going to be tuning out to what you have to say. Now, just to give you an example of that, you know, in Canada right now, there's a great political controversy about one of our cabinet ministers who expensed a $16 glass of orange juice at a London hotel in the UK. Now, anybody who's been to London knows that $16 is actually not a bad price for a glass of orange juice in some London hotels. But that caused great outrage in Ottawa and across the country. Now, that would be surprising because governments can waste hundreds of millions of dollars, let alone billions of dollars, and nobody bats an eye. But people understand how much it costs to buy a whole jug of orange juice, let alone a glass, and they know it's an awful lot cheaper than $16, and that to them is waste. So the more numbers that you have in it, and science is terrible for this, the less likely you are to leave a memorable impression and to have people understand what you're talking about. So facts are good to support, but figures generally bad. Another thing to keep in mind is the more you can personalize things, either your own experience, the experience of people around you, or the experience in society, the more likely it is that people are going to actually care about what you're saying and remember it after the fact. So in terms of support, Keep in mind, why should people care about what I'm talking about? And then if you can find ways to personalize those facts, that would lead to a very good interview. Now on to the next slide. That's slide number 13. And the last portion of what to say. Simplifying. And again, this is very, very important for anybody in the medical field or scientists in general. If you were to ask any reporter what interview they feared the most, they wouldn't talk about the Secretary General of the United Nations or political leaders. The interviews that they fear the most are usually with scientists. Because you have to remember that reporters are like me in a lot of ways. You know, we went into the fields that we went into because we really couldn't hack the math or hack the science. A lot of you know, BAs in the journalism departments. So you know, math, science, that all scares them, and they can't talk with any great sense of certainty or knowledge about the issue, where anybody can have an opinion on a public policy issue or on the polls and whether someone's doing a good job or a bad job. So that's why it's so important in your fields to keep in mind that you have to simplify things. And again, you have to realize that who the audience is that you're speaking to. So, you know, you're not speaking to your colleagues. Usually it's not a peer-reviewed setting. You're speaking to the general public. And that's why you should really stick to the basics and use analogies. There's a reason why most religious leaders all speak in parables, because it's you know, it's memorable and easy to understand. So if you can be more of a poet than a PhD, that will lead to a successful interview. And now again, you know, there might be some scorn heaped on you in the staff room for you know, describing some sort of complicated scientific experiment or finding, you know, like an apple or like a, you know, something very simple. But again, you're not there to impress the staff room necessarily. You're there to impart a message. And the better you are at that, the more interviews you get and the more outlets call on you and the more public profile you'll be able to get. So simplifying, it's very important. And that's what I've talked a little bit about on slide 14, is just, again, when you're thinking about your messaging and thinking about your interview, just to keep in mind that it's important to state it in a way that that gets your message across and support it, again, and simplify it. So if you start with those three things, you're already on the way to a very, very good interview. So that brings me to slide 15 and the next section, which is how to say it. So you've figured out what you want to say. Now you need to think about how to say it. And the first thing to do you have to start thinking in sound bites, which again is quite foreign to people in the medical field and to scientists in general. You have to be brief. The average clip on TV or the average quote in a newspaper, the average clip on TV is now something like 7 seconds. So you can imagine that you have about 7 seconds to get all that you want to say across, or about 10 words. So if you just think about that, that's not an awful lot of time. So you have to be able to summarize succinctly everything that you want to say on an issue, or at least your entire answer, into a 7-second soundbite or a 10-word clip in print. And again, this is completely foreign to a lot of people in the medical field and scientists in general, because usually you're marked on how much you possibly know on a given topic, and that means talking about everything. But when it comes to media interviews, brevity is key, and you need to keep those numbers in the back of your head, 7 seconds or 10 words. A lot of people think that they can get around the 7 second 10 word rule by adding things like and or but. But a soundbite has to be self-contained. You can't, you know, if you add an and or if you add a but, that means that a journalist will likely clip either before the and or after the and. And when people talk and come complaining to me about being misquoted or being taken out of context, usually it's because their answers aren't self-contained, that they've tried to extend that and they've added a, on the other hand, or and either an editor or the reporter themselves has been forced to clip things. So if you don't want to be in that situation of being misquoted, because usually misquoted means that they've just taken the wrong section, and people say, you know, when I've asked them, well, did you say that? They say, yes, I did, but I also said this. So you need to keep things self-contained. No jargon or acronyms. And again, this is going to be very difficult in a medical setting, or even in a public sector setting, because it's filled with acronyms and filled with jargon. And most people who actually work in the situation, work with you, probably don't know half of the acronyms. The general public has absolutely no hope of knowing what everything stands for. So take a good look at what it is you're going to be saying and try to rid it of any medical jargon or acronyms. Another way to get clipped is to be colorful. But again, that's a double-edged sword. You need to be colorful in a good way. If you're a little bit too flip, and as a Newfoundlander by birth, and anybody in Canada listening knows Newfoundlanders, we tend to be fairly colorful. There are a lot of times when being a little bit too colorful gets you in trouble. But if you can be colorful in terms of your sound bites, that's a guaranteed way of getting clipped. So on to the next slide. And here I'm going to be talking a little bit about bridging. And bridging is just simply, you can see by the picture there, it's taking you from one place and safely transporting you to another. And, when you're going to be using this is when interviews and questions turn to some place that you really don't want to be talking about. It's either a difficult subject or it's going off in a completely different direction. Bridging is a way of getting things back to your plan, that plan that you spent, the 5 or 10 minutes talking about. That's also a way to exercise a little bit of control in the interview. So, it sounds pretty fancy, but it's actually fairly easy topic or easy technique once you get to learn it. And on 17, I'm going to talk a little bit more about how to bridge successfully from things. So the key technique or the key part of bridging is that you have to listen carefully to the question and answer or acknowledge or refute what you can of it. So usually it's a difficult question, one that you probably planned for. You can't ignore it completely, but you need to answer at least a portion of it to be able to move on and bridge to the topics that you want to talk about. And you've got a transition phase in between, a phrase in between there that helps you get things back on track. So I've put a couple, but you could probably come up with a long list of ways to bridge and using successful transition phases. I hear what you're saying is the transition, but what I really want to talk about is this, or I can't speculate on that, but what I can say is this, or, on the contrary, the real issue is, or yes, that's a very good point, but another challenge that we face or that comes into play is this. So with difficult questions and questions that you don't necessarily want to answer, you can bridge or pivot to your main messages by just simply acknowledging or answering or refuting what you can and then using a transition phase to get you back to your plan. Now, on the next slide, there's a difference between bridging and blocking. So then, you know, the last thing you want to do, everything has to be smooth when you're doing a bridge from the topic that you don't want to talk about to the topic that you do. It has to be very smooth. If it looks like you're trying to hide the truth or avoid the question entirely, then you're blocking, and reporters will keep coming back, and it looks like then to the public and to people listening that you're just avoiding the question. But if you bridge instead, so talk about what you can and then bring things to your main messaging, then it won't look like that at all. It looks like you're being completely forthcoming, and you probably are as forthcoming as you possibly can about a given topic. So that's an important thing. You want to be a bridge, and you don't want to be a blocker. So that moves me on to the next slide, which again, it's kind of a variation on this, but it's what to do and how to answer difficult questions. And the first thing to keep in mind is that you just can't ignore a tough question. You know, unless you're the President of the United States and you have a helicopter that you're walking into, you can pretend that you don't hear the question and hop on to the helicopter. But not very many of us are ever in that position to have a helicopter at our beck and call. So you can't ignore a tough question and hope it goes away, because a reporter will keep coming back to it thinking that's the issue and now we've got them. If you don't know the answer, say that you don't know the answer. The number of people, politicians especially, that get themselves in trouble by talking about something they have absolutely no clue about, the numbers go off the chart. So probably the most important thing you can say if you truly don't know the answer to something is to say, I don't know the answer to that, but I'd be happy to get back to you or, follow up or something like that. If you can't answer, and sometimes there's often legal and patient confidentiality reasons why you can't answer a certain question, it's always a good idea to explain why. People are usually quite understanding about why you can't get into to certain things. So you can't answer because it has to be more than because you don't want to. But if you can't answer for various legal or ethical reasons, it'd be good to explain why. Now, in doing that, you don't want to appear glib or dismissive or cold. You know, particularly if there's been some tragedy involved in the interview, if there's been a death or something happened related to either an issue or a patient care thing. You don't want to come across as appearing overly glib or dismissive when you're citing patient confidentiality reasons. I think also you don't want to appear trite as well. I'm not a big fan of the PR experts that say, especially when talking about a death or a tragedy, you know, first let me say that, you know, our hearts and prayers or my condolences go out to, you can appear fairly dismissive as well if you just do a rote answer. And when answering difficult questions, you need to also stand your ground. So if you don't know the answer, or if you can't answer for various reasons, for goodness sakes, stick to that and don't be worn down and suddenly on the third time being asked, change your answer. So on to the next slide. So we've talked a little bit about difficult questions. What I'd like to get into now is avoiding the traps. And there are some techniques that journalists use sometimes to get you to say things that you might not necessarily want to be talking about. And there's various things various techniques that are used. Hypothetical questions, for example, are a great way for journalists to get you to try to get you to be talking about things that you don't necessarily want to be talking about. So, you know, if, for example, such and such a disease broke out in a major city like Chicago or Toronto, what would happen to hypothetical questions like that. When we're talking to politicians, we tell them never, ever talk about hypothetical questions. Just stick to the facts. But you know, if this, then what would you do? Is a common way of trying to get people to talk about things that they don't want to talk about. Another way that that reporters can get you to maybe say a little bit more is by using dead air. Now, when you're in an interview session, and just maybe in general, if you're having a conversation, if there is dead air after an answer that you've given or after some sort of discussion, there's a huge human tendency to want to fill that dead space. You know, has the person not really understood? So, you know, if I suddenly stopped speaking now, there'd be a real tendency to want to come in there with something. And reporters on radio and even print reporters use that often to try and get you to say more about a topic. Another thing that's used, another technique, is just playing dumb. Now, as we talked about on the scientific field and medical field, sometimes it's not often playing, but you know, often reporters will say, "Well, I'm just a dumb reporter, and you know, what do I know about science or you know, public health matters?" Often they know a fair deal. This is just simply another way to try and get you to say more about a topic that you may necessarily want to say. So you know, you can answer it in different ways, as long as you're staying within those parameters that you outlined in your plan. Another thing is of course between friends, or you know, some reporters will make a big play about either turning off their recorder, having a chat with you when the light has gone off. This sort of between friends, you know, now that that's out of the way, what do you really think, is often used. And you just need to keep in mind that you're always on the record, and sometimes some of the best quotes for a reporter and the worst quotes for an interview subject comes when that notepad has been closed up. Another thing that you have to avoid is personal opinion. So if you're speaking to a reporter as the lead scientist on a project, or the head of a department, or the chief of staff to a hospital, you can't ever take off that hat and just speak as a scientist or a physician or as an average citizen. So answering questions like, well, you know, or if you were the chief of staff, or if you weren't the chief of staff, what would your opinion be on this? So there can't be any daylight between any of your answers. So on to the next slide, and that brings us to the next section, really. So we've talked a lot about what to say, and a lot about how to say it. And now I'd like to end off maybe going through some practical tips about the various techniques that you would use depending on where you're saying things. So on to slide 22. In terms of the media experiences that you're going to have, you're going to be faced with a number of situations. One of them is often a face-to-face interview, usually print or radio. And there's a few things to keep in mind in those situations. So your body language says an awful lot. So your words could sound very cool, calm, and collected, but if you're mopping your brow, or your eyes are flitting back and forth, or you're pulling at your collar, that transmits a completely different message. Also, give some thought to where you're doing the interview. For example, if there's been some questions about inappropriate expenditures on a budget, if you're doing the interview at the private club with mahogany walls, that sends a completely different message. It's also important to know your issues and to know them in depth. because people are coming to you as the expert on a certain subject or a certain issue, so you should really know your facts. And also, as we talked about before, remember that a reporter is going to be talking to people with opposing views, and they could have no validity whatsoever, but as long as they're opposing, they'll be talking to those folks, so you need to prepare for that and not be too angry when you see their names in print or see their faces on the screen. The next slide is interviews by phone. And everything that I talked about earlier applies to all of these things, but there's a couple of techniques that you should keep in mind if you're ever doing a interview by phone, especially when you're dealing with radio reporters. So in terms of that, something to keep in mind is that your tone and your pace are very important. And there's one trick that someone taught me an awfully long time ago is to stand up when you're doing a radio interview. It just comes across much better to the listeners than, you know, someone who's seated in a chair, perhaps, you know, slouched back a little bit more relaxed. If you stand up, it's going to make a huge difference in terms of your tone. It's going to look awfully silly, but it comes across very well. It's also important to have a hard line without call waiting. So if you can be on a hard line doing that interview, it's not always possible, but it is preferable if you can. And without call waiting is important because as soon as you're on the radio, especially if it's live, you can be sure that your family and friends are calling up saying, "Hey, I'm listening to you on the radio right now." And so you don't want that annoying beep, or you can tell when someone has kind of faded out and faded it back in when there's call waiting. It's also important to minimize distractions, which is not often easy in a lot of the settings that you work in. But if you can find a quiet space, preferably with in an office with a door that closes, something that you can put a sign on saying, you know, "Please do not disturb. I'm doing, you know, doing an interview." That would be great. And also, again, if there are windows, people can see you, you can see them. It's good to turn away from all of that and face the wall if you can, because people can tell when you're distracted over the radio. So on to the next slide, and I'll stick with radio for a little bit, because hopefully if you're doing radio, you can actually do it in studio. That's far preferable to doing something over the phone. So if you have a choice and you have the opportunity to get into a studio to talk to the reporter one-on-one, that would be what I recommend. So with radio, it's important to remember that you're not necessarily talking to the listeners, you're talking to the interviewer. Radio is very conversational, so it's all about having a chat and connecting with that interviewer. It may seem pretty obvious, but it's also important to listen to the questions that you're being asked. Now, oftentimes, depending on how busy the radio host is and how prepared or how much time they've had to prepare, they may not be listening to your answers. They may have a list of questions that they're getting through, and you may find yourself answering the same questions a couple of times, but don't worry about that. It's important for you to listen to the questions and provide the answers to the best of your ability, and again, have that conversation with the interviewer. And on to the next slide, slide number 25. That's we move from radio now to television. So with live television, impressions are absolutely everything when it comes to TV interviews. And I'll get into in the next slide a little bit about more on that. But you have to remember that it's important that it's the entire package. So it's not just what you're saying; it's, you know, how you look saying it. It's where you're looking, all that sort of thing. When it comes to live television, one of the questions that I'm often asked is, "Well, where do I look?" So usually you've got a camera and an interviewer. And when you're in studio and there's an interviewer there, your eyes should be on the interviewer and not the camera. So it shouldn't go back and forth between the interviewer and the camera. Just keep your eyes on the interviewer. Again, body language matters. So if you're in a chair that swivels, if you're swiveling back and forth in the chair or tilting back and forth, all of that matters and is a distraction. And with the voice, again, your tone and pace matter. And in TV, what happens often is that it's a sort of a deadening medium when it comes to the voice. So in radio, it can be more conversational. In TV, you have to have a little bit more inflection in your voice for it to come across well. And also, finally, looks do matter. And that brings me to my next slide. Now, this one really only works for Canadians, unfortunately, who know who Don Cherry is. But anyways, he's a former National Hockey League coach who is now a commentator on TV, and he has a propensity to wear what look to be sofa covers and drapes as his suits on TV. So that's what that picture is, and I think these are actual suits that he's worn on TV. So that being said, that is not the way, unless you've got the panache of a Don Cherry and the personality of a Don Cherry, that is not how I recommend dressing for TV, although it would be quite memorable and people would certainly be talking about it for weeks, if not months. But when it comes to dressing for TV, there's a number of things to keep in mind. And the first is the colors that you're wearing. Colors to avoid on TV are blacks, which tend to, all the light is, of course, sucked out. So with blacks, you tend to get lost in the background and look like a bit of a floating head, depending on what's behind you. So avoid very, very dark colors like black. Now, you're saying, you've probably seen people, news anchors on TV, with what look to be black suits, but they're usually navy blue, and navy blue will appear black on TV, but you certainly don't want to wear black, either, black dresses or black suits. You also don't want white, because white, you have the appearance of glowing, like you have an aura. Now, some doctors like that look a fair deal, but I would avoid the whites. You want to look to an off-white, a cream, will come across as white on camera. Another thing to avoid are bright colors, because they have a tendency to strobe and to almost glow, and so you want to avoid that. So you can wear color, but a little bit more muted, maybe on the pastels. In terms of patterns, the rule of thumb is that you want to have fairly wide patterns instead of, the more narrow the pattern, what you're going to get is a fair amount of strobing on camera, so it looks like you're electric. So you want to keep the patterns fairly wide, so if their polka dots should be large, stripes fairly large. In terms of jewelry, you should avoid it. Avoid having anything that's very dangly or shiny and sparkly, because the eye is where humans are like magpies. They're easily distracted, and so if you're on TV and you've got huge dangly earrings or a big shiny watch or a chain of some sort that's sparkling, people will pay attention to that and not on what you're saying. Now, a lot in the audience are probably wondering about, I put makeup there, and it's important that for TV anyways, usually there is hopefully a makeup artist on site, but even men, if you have a little bit of, some powder that you can put on your forehead, depending on how big that forehead is, that's important. And the ladies as well, just make sure that your makeup is good. And again, the same idea about colors apply there. So if it's bright lipstick, then it'll look like like it's a neon light around your lips instead of just makeup. And again, at all times, minimize distraction, because we're easily distracted. So on to the next slide, and this is the double ender. So this is where you're not talking to someone in studio, but you're talking to a camera. So someone is probably an anchor or a reporter is in a studio at some other city or some other part of the city, and there's you're facing a camera, and you've got their voice in your ear through an earpiece. It's probably the most difficult and unnatural interview that you'll face, because you know we naturally have a tendency to want to talk to people and see the people that we're talking to. But with a double ender, you don't have that opportunity. You're just looking at a camera. So in the studio where I've told you to take a to look at the interviewer, with a double ender, your eyes need to be fixed on that lens, right in the center of that lens. And that's a little bit difficult to get used to, because usually there's a monitor probably at your feet or over to the side where you can actually see the people that you're talking to. But you don't want to be looking at that. You want to be looking directly at the camera, because you need to treat the camera as their face. Otherwise, if you're flipping back and forth, you kind of look shifty. Important to note that the camera is always on. So just because they're not talking to you or because they've gone on to other things, if that red light on the camera is on, that means that you're on, and there's a potential that your face and whatever you're doing is going to be live on camera. Another important thing to keep in mind is you need to get comfortable with the earpiece. So the volume needs to be right for you. So spend a lot of time with the technician, with the people at the other end, whether they're in another city, just making sure the volume is right, everything is comfortable, and that you're ready to go. Because you don't have time, if it's not loud enough, don't think that it's going to get louder during the interview, because it just may not. Oftentimes, you're on a panel, so there could be two or three or four people all doing double enders on a panel in a newscast. And again, just keep in mind that even if it's the other person talking and that light's on, the camera could be on you. So if you're shaking your head in disgust or rolling your eyes, there is a possibility that all of that is going to be on camera. And again, with that in mind, wait for the final all clear. So you need to get an all clear from possibly the technician or from the person in your ear saying, good, we're done. Just because they may have gone away from you, said thank you very much for the interview, doesn't mean that that camera is off, so you could still be on screen for a while. So if it's a rough interview, you don't want a picture of you tossing out your earpiece in disgust. So just wait for the all clear. Now, very quickly, because I know we're running short on time, I'm just going to go through a couple of situations that you're likely to face in terms of where to say it. The first is news conferences, and this is possibly the most organized and formal experience that you'll have, and they're fairly structured. Usually, there's an opening statement. There's often a moderator. And, you're often asked to give a statement on a given topic, which could last anywhere from 3 to 5 minutes. And then there's a formal question and answer period, usually dictated by a moderator, and it usually lasts for 10 or 20 minutes. The good thing about news conferences is you have the ability to adjust your messaging, not change it radically, but you can adjust it as the news conference is going on. It also gives you the opportunity to identify people that you would like to follow up with. So if someone has asked you either an in-depth question or something that you'd like to say more on, you can always say, I'll follow up with you later, or be happy to get that information and come talk to you after the event. So it's very formal. And it gives you an opportunity to take advantage of all of your planning. On the next slide, the complete opposite to that, and you see the rugby scrum there, is what's known as a scrum. And that is possibly, I know Paul and I were talking about it just before the conference, it is possibly the worst, most horrific, fearful thing that you'll ever face. Just like a rugby scrum, reporters and cameras are all jostling for position. The mood is usually a little bit testy. Questions are coming from all over the place. And you are the rugby ball somewhere in the middle of that that scrum. But on the next slide, I do have a few things to keep in mind. That, again, I talked at the very beginning about having control. Actually, have more control in a scrum than you think. And hopefully nobody will ever be in one, but just in case you are, the number one thing to keep in mind is to stay calm and to be brief in your answers. You want to give the impression that you face scrums every single day of the week, that you've just walked out of your office it's time for my 3 p.m. scrum. You know, good to see everybody. So, you know, again, body language, tone, and pace are very important. There's a few tricks. Again, you know, questions are coming fast and furious, but you can decide which one to answer first. You can't avoid difficult questions forever, but you can decide which question to take and what order to do it. And the most important thing is to always have an exit strategy. So that you need to find a way, whether it's a staffer or whether, you know what, I'm happy to take more questions at another time, but right now I have to, you know, go save a life or go here, go there. But it's always important to have an exit strategy when it comes to a scrum. And that, on the final slide there, is the conclusion. It's hard to over the phone to see a standing ovation, but it's always good to imagine one as a presenter. My contact information is on the slide following, but through Paul, I'm also happy to answer any questions that anybody has. So with that, maybe thank you very much for your attention, and I'll throw things back over to Paul.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for including your email address. Hopefully you don't get swamped. That was an extremely practical demonstration of how to handle yourself around media. I have several questions, but obviously we don't have time for too many. I wanted to approach one thing. When you're the hospital director and something has just gone wrong in your hospital and your secretary comes in to say that Lyndon McIntyre of the Fifth Estate or somebody from 60 Minutes or 2020 is on the phone, do you take their call? And if so, how do you handle it?
Well, here's the good news is that you know, your tendency would be to say, well, I have to take it take that right away. But you know, if you're in an administrative position and if you're likely to be getting media requests on a regular basis, it's very good to set up a procedure right off the bat with the folks that are answering the phones. So, you know, what you want them to do is to take Lyndon McIntyre's message or the folks from 60 Minutes, their details, and find out, you know, who they are, what their telephone numbers are, why they're calling, and probably most importantly is, you know, what their deadline is. So if their deadline is 1 p.m., then, you know, you need to make an arrangement to call them back before then. So you don't have to take any of these calls right away. Now, you know, if Lyndon McIntyre is in your waiting room with a camera or you're being followed to the parking lot by a camera, it gets a little bit more difficult. But, you know, it's really important to take some time, whether it's just 5, 10, 15 minutes to think about what it is you're going to be talking about and what it is you're going to be saying. So yes, you don't have to take these calls right away.
Mm. Now, you are on the board of the International Journal of Communication in Healthcare, and I'm very sorry to say that I have never heard of that journal, but it sounds fascinating. Can you tell me just very briefly what it does?
Well, it's you know, it's wide ranging, and it talks a little bit more. It covers more than just simply straight communications or media relations. There's it's peer reviewed, and it covers an extensive range of topics. There's been a number of articles that I've reviewed recently, just about public health information campaigns and various you know. various projects targeting some North American Native communities and some of the health challenges that they face, and looking at ways to communicate very important health information to them. Or it could be the use of social media, for example. There's been a number of articles on social media in an academic setting, and also between patients and physicians. So it's pretty wide ranging.
Sounds like a very useful journal. I think I might have a look at that. But thank you again very much. I've very much enjoyed this. As I said, sometimes our teleclasses are filled with fantastic science, but it's very difficult to apply them in a practical way. This has been quite the opposite. It's been very practical and very down to earth, and I appreciate that very much. So to all of you, I thank you very much for joining us today. And Jim, thank you again very much. I've really enjoyed this, and I think it's been very helpful for a lot of people. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you, Paul.
So until we meet again, goodbye.